Well, welcome to the Collector's Show. I'm Harold Nickel here on Web Talk Radio. Happy summer, everybody. And while the live-in might not necessarily be easy, like that song promised us it would be, it is time for everybody to take a break. And so I hope that you'll indulge me taking a break this week and listening to one of the most popular interviews we ever did on the Collector's Show. This is from about 5 years ago. It's the Label Man. This is a man who collects fruit crate labels. It's a fascinating collection, and a way that this individual took his career in such a different direction with such a unique collection. I thought that as long as we were going to be doing a best of, let's pick among the better, older interviews that we ever did. Next week, we'll be back with a regular show. We'll be talking about collecting radios, and specifically transistor radios. You won't want to miss that. In the meantime, I hope you'll enjoy this replay from 2009, The Label Man, here on Web Talk Radio. During the interview segment of this week's program, we are very pleased to be joined by Dwayne Rogers. Dwayne is known for his hobby of collecting all types of labels and is known as The Label Man. He also owns a very popular website, thelabelman.com, and he's an expert on collecting of all things different types of labels. And hello, Dwayne. Welcome to the Collector's Show.
Hi, Harold. How are you doing today?
Very, very well. You talked with us once before about collecting salmon can labels and how you got into that. But just for the benefit of people who've joined our audience since then, can you give us a little bit of background on how you came to be interested in collecting different kinds of labels?
Yes, when I was younger, I worked for the USDA as an ag inspector. And so it was in California, and what we do is I'd be traveling up and down the state working at different packing plants, just quality control. And I ran into this is back like in 1978, and I ran into a guy who collected labels. And he was fanatical about it, and I started seeing labels from my hometown that he had. And back then, people just kind of traded them back and forth, and packing plants had piles of them. And once you met somebody, you started doing it. There's other collectors, too. So what happened is as I traveled up and down, following different crops every year, I started meeting different collectors, and we started trading back and forth, and it just progressed from there.
So you'll forgive the pun if I say that your hobby grew organically.
You could say that. You could say that.
Now, I'm interested specifically in fruit crate labels. Now, what is a fruit crate, and how and why are they labeled?
Well, basically, it's like a packaging requirement. You know, back they always used to use wood boxes to package stuff, and you'd always have to have some kind of identity on the box. And basically, this is ephemera. It was made to be pasted on a box, and then that would prove, you know, give it the identity. And as the box shipped across the country, you know, you'd know where it came from, who packed it, who's responsible for it. And like if I shipped a box of oranges from California to Michigan, you know, when it got to Michigan, if they were spoiled and there was no label on it, you'd be a lot more harder recourse on it. Because a lot of times, you know, these things would change hands. A load of produce might change hands for different brokers. And so basically it was a form of identity.
Okay, so but what I'm thinking of a fruit crate label, and I know that when I was growing up in Texas, I worked at a grocery store, and they would have lettuce or onions or things like that that would come in. Mm-hmm. My assumption then was that all of the labels were the same. It just labeled lettuce from Rio Grande Vegetable Company in Brownsville, Texas.
Yeah.
Isn't that the case with all fruit crates? They're all the same?
No, what it is at some point it became, I don't know if it was an ego or a competition, but artwork started getting more involved in it, and it became very artistically desirable. And part of it was, I guess in some of the places you'd have, and this goes back to like the 1890s, and there's when it first started doing, and probably around 1900, 1910, it really started picking up. The artwork was just incredible. And I think back then they did everything much more elaborate than they do nowadays, more attention to detail. I think probably when we were talking about the 1950s, by that time it was actually was more what they call a marketing phase. You might see more of the identity and things like that, but you wouldn't have the nice artwork that you'd find back like in the 1920s, 30s, in that period of time.
And I want to get to the artwork, but if you're just joining us, it's the Collector Show with Harold Nickel, and this week we're talking with Dwayne Rogers, the label man, and we're talking specifically about collecting Fruit Crate labels. So we talked for a minute about the artwork, and I know that when we talk about art and printing from the 1890s, even the early 20th century, the process for that was far more labor-intensive than what it is today.
Yes.
Is part of that process what makes these more or less collectible?
I think that's a big part of it, because it is. They're like early prints. Any time you get color print from like 1920 or earlier, it's always beautiful.
Yeah.
The colors are more subdued.
And somebody with a paintbrush had to sit down and paint these portraits. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think part of it, you know, we always have this indication, like nowadays you can go get something printed at a Kinko's. But back then, if you wanted color print in 1900, you had to have it was a big process, like we were saying, I mean, the stones or even the printing presses and things. So there was big operations. And a lot of these lithograph companies that printed the labels, they were these big warehouses that have massive, you know, banks of artists. They had they printed other material too, and it was they were big manufacturing companies.
Yeah, and people don't, I think, remember in advertising there was a trade known as a sign painter, where somebody would actually go out with a brush in their paints and paint signs for stores or for various companies in the forms of advertising, and it sounds to me like this is very similar to that kind of an operation.
I think to some extent, I think what we had in, there were different phases. Like, let's say, well, we can go down to Texas. I'm not quite as familiar with the areas, but let's say the printing company was in Houston. Actually, most of our printing companies, San Francisco was Baltimore. A lot of them were immigrants. There was Schmidt was one of the biggest ones. Trong was another big one. And they were German immigrants. And they were very good with printing and art. And what happened is, so you had this San Francisco, you had this big printing company. Schmidt was in San Francisco, in Los Angeles. And if you had an orchard that was like up in the foothills or something, they'd have like a salesman come out. And he would pretty much sketch out or get an idea from you of what you want on your label. And then he'd take that back, and then they'd have this bank of artists, and the artists would draw it up. And sometimes you have like artists that would might just do the fruit vignettes or do the image, and then you might have someone who's in charge of just doing fonts. Fonts are like a really big part of labels. I never understood it at first, but graphic designers, they like labels a lot. And what they would do is they come after the fonts, when the fonts are one of the main things they really enjoy.
Well, in terms of printing, and I know this from my advertising background, and I fight with art directors all the time about font choices, because art directors are artists, and the choice of the font is really something that could make a label or an advertisement or a letter or even an email more or less readable, because the serif fonts, what I always learned coming up in the ad writing trade, was that serif fonts were far more readable, friendly to your eye, than were the sans serif fonts. So I can understand that. And even now, in a world of computer-generated communications and signs and labels, every art director I know is in love with the Arial sans serif font, which and reversed, which might as well be written in invisible ink, because it's just unreadable. So, but it sounds like the experience of the people who designed these labels were very similar.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't. I mean, like I said before, it was all kind of new to me. I actually had a graphic designer not too long ago, and she made the comment again. It was the fonts that really intrigue her.
Yeah. Yeah, it can make or break any kind of labeling. So in the early part of the 20th century, they would sketch these out with a pencil, and the farmer or the orchard owner would approve the label.
Yeah.
And then they'd go on and do, and I think there were glass all kinds of plating and photography went into those label creations. Is that not right?
I think they really, I think the phototype came around. I think they did have experimental phototype printing back like 1900, but it didn't turn out really well. And I don't think it was until the 1930s they did the phototype. I think what they would use is, I'm not quite as up on that, but you know, they went from their limestones. I think most of these were probably printed on copper plates or zinc plates. And then you'd have your, you know, your, all your color separation. Actually, you'd have your, the guy would sketch it up, and then you'd have your artist put it together. And then after it was all put together, you'd have the printers would, like, take it apart.
Right.
They'd have to separate the colors for the printing process, and then they'd come through and they'd print out, they'd print them out in these big sheets. And every so often you'd run across a sheet. And a sheet could be anywhere from up to maybe 4 or 5 feet square or something. And with the printing press, would print a full sheet. And what they would do is they would stick just different stuff on there to make it fit so they, you know, they could maximize the space. And so you get these big sheets and have, like, different types of labels on it and stuff. And they'd print these, you know, a few thousand sheets, and then they had the area where they cut. They'd cut these out. And then they'd bundle them up, 1,000 labels per bundle, and then they'd ship them out.
So for the cutting part of the printing process, you described the four-color printing process and how they came to be. Then they were, I guess, die-cut and glued onto the fruit crate. How did any of these labels survive the rigors of shipping, handling, thrown around, thrown away? How are there any of these left any place?
Actually, the part is that people don't really want the ones that were used on boxes. What happens is you make, like, an orange company. They get quite large. You've probably seen some of the Texas big citrus plants.
Oh, yeah.
So you'd have, you know, you pack 200 or 300 boxes, 200 or 300,000 boxes of oranges. And the thing about, and when you order labels, you have to order labels ahead of time, and then they have to set up their printer. I mean, they can't just do it overnight for you, because they have, like, a queue when they set up their facility for this run. And then what happens is, you know, they print a bunch and they send it to you. So if you run out of labels in the middle of the season, you virtually can't ship your produce.
That's right.
So what happens is you always have leftover labels. And it depends on how people clean. Like, if the plant was never destroyed or burned down, if it always stayed there, even if it was abandoned sometimes, there'd always be an area where they had all these labels sitting in there. And back in the 1960s, people started kind of accumulating these. You know, they go into plants and they get the stuff. And it's very rare to find it now at a plant. But basically, it's just all the stuff that was left over in warehouse-type finds.
That's amazing that. But I guess it also gets to the other kinds of rare finds that we talk about on the program, where somebody will stumble across a rare find. Do you yourself go out rummaging through warehouses and docks and wharfs?
I was an ag inspector, I did a lot.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, every day, I guess.
Like 30 years ago. But nowadays, I do go to, like, if I'm in an area and there's produce companies, I'll go up there and I'll knock on doors. But they've been bugged so much that, in some respects, I think they tell you they don't have anything because they don't want to be bothered anymore. But I think there still is a lot of the stuff out there. But people are aware there's some value, and they've got it kind of, like, you know, away from the rats and things like that. They've got it cleaned up somewhere.
Now, well, if I were to call, I don't know, Del Monte today and say, gee, I'd like to buy some sheets of labels from you, or if I called one of the big produce companies, would I be able to, or would they just, like what you said, just tell me to beat it and we don't have
any?
Yeah,
I don't think they really would want to be bothered with it.
That's incredible. It just seems like a chance for them to make, it just sounds like another revenue stream to me. You know, we'll print up 100,000 labels for our fruit boxes and then another 10 for people who collect them.
It's kind of like, actually, well, nowadays they don't print them up nowadays, so it's completely different. But, you know, the funny thing about these is you can't really copy the designs. There's a lot of people, there are people who do want labels. It's not very common, but they do want a label for their, maybe for advertising, or maybe they have a display, and they want someone to create a label for them, and usually it's done on computer and things. And you just don't get that look.
Yeah, there's something to be said for the conveniences of programs like Adobe Illustrator or Photoshop. They make art accessible to people who can't draw, But then there's something to be said, I think, for the art and decorating value. Let's talk for a minute about that, because when I was reading your website, thelabelman.com, there were sections on there about decorating. Tell us about that.
Actually, what happens is most of my clients are decorators. There's collectors, but you know, it's really a small amount. I think there's like maybe 5 or 10 collectors in Texas who are avid collectors. You know, another 4 or 5 or 10 in Arizona, and quite a few in California and Florida and Washington. But for the most part, it's decorators, and they like they're like mini collectors too. Sometimes they have a small collection of, you know, maybe 25 or 50 labels, and then sometimes they just buy enough just to cover a wall to decorate. And people collect them. They like to decorate with like local type labels. They like good graphics. Some people like birds. There was actually a museum up in upstate New York somewhere that bought a bunch of bird labels from me, and they wanted to do like a display of bird labels.
No kidding.
And things. It was nice. And I get a lot of like, you have like historical type homes, and what they'll do is they'll contact me and they want labels from a certain period. You've heard of the X-Man?
Oh, sure.
Well, I had the X-Man. I guess they film them in London, and they bought a bunch of can labels from me last year. And they were doing, what do they call that, the prelude to the X-Man? I guess they're filming it right now, and what it is, it's a, how the X-Men developed, and it goes back in like the 1940s, the storyline does, and what they wanted, they had a kitchen, and they wanted some labels for this kitchen.
Oh, okay.
And things like that. So you get a lot of people looking for period-type stuff, too.
Oh, that's neat. And the other thing that really interested me, you know, from back when we first talked, I guess, a year and a half, 2 years ago, was that you have taken your hobby, which we described how you got involved in this earlier because of your work with the ag department, but this is your job now. You've been able to take your hobby and turn it into a job.
Yeah, it's amazing. I have a hard time believing it sometimes, but yeah, it's been about almost 12 years now that I've done it, and we've paid all our bills off. Things, you know, we're not really wealthy. I'm not buying new vehicles and taking elaborate trips, but it covers everything.
But I think so many people, whether it's their collection or golf or pick a hobby, being on the radio, would love to be able to do that. Did you start your business while you still had your regular day job, or did you just one day decide, nope, I'm going all out into the label collecting and sale and trade business?
Actually, I used to do, you know, the street shows they have. California has a lot of, like, street shows and
right.
antique shows. And so I used to do a lot of those. 1 year, almost every weekend, we were somewhere. And usually, you know, it's a drive and a lot of work. And it was a lot of fun, but it really wasn't very profitable. And I used to do that in work. And then eBay. eBay really was the catalyst.
Right.
eBay came along, and I got a lot of exposure. I was watching it going on, people selling. And I was on there when they first started, like, within the first year that they started. And so it just kind of...
Okay, and if you could just say and spell your name for me, if you could.
Okay, my name is Bob Kautzman, Kautzman.
Okay, let's check.
Took off, and at some point, you do kind of have to make the decision. You make this leap from your job into this, and my job was boring. It was nice, it was safe. But it was really boring.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think so many of us, like I say, would like to convert. And I see that you have, in over 15,000 transactions on eBay, you have a 100% positive rating. So you're servicing collectors and, you know, making a few bucks at it. 15,000 is a lot of anything.
Actually, I have to say that website's kind of, they changed the way they do that on eBay, but I'm almost to 25,000.
Wow. Still.
And actually, the website puts out about 1,000 packages a year.
Man, good for you. That is so cool. Now,
amazing, yeah.
In any kind of printed media, labels, baseball cards, art, there are there's counterfeits.
Yeah.
Do you run into counterfeit labels?
There is there's one person who does a lot of, it's a long story, but she does a lot of reproductions, and people tend to offer, like sometimes they'll offer me, this one woman had some really great stuff, and I started looking at it, and what it was an old calendar that had been taken apart, and she thought they were the labels.
Oh.
So you see that, and you see more of it nowadays. I don't see anybody really intentionally trying to sell reproductions as real labels, but, you know, sometimes they don't know, or in some respects, you know, that actually comes back to they really don't know. There hasn't been, like, all-out thing on reproducing them yet.
Okay, so there's not, though, the amount of forgeries there are for labels like there are with comic books or...
No, not too much. If you're a collector, though, and if you're going to spend a lot of money, you need to kind of get a little bit of an idea. You need to get a few look at them. They're pretty easy to tell if they're like 1940 or earlier.
Yeah, how can we tell?
You can tell by the print, sometimes the smell of them, and they get like a musty smell to them, and also the back of them. There's always going to be a little bit of aging from the 1940s. And after the 40s, sometimes it depends on the paper and how much acid was in the paper and things, if they age or not. But when you get into like the 50s and 60s, they look like a color copy.
Yeah, the aging of the white paper, it'll turn a little brown because of oxidation.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even fake that, but I'm not going to describe how because I don't want to.
I agree.
No, I don't want to give anybody any bad ideas. And go ahead.
So far, they haven't gotten that far, but it's not as big of a market. I do really well, but there's only a handful of people that really make a living out of selling labels. Where I think baseball cards and things, you probably have a lot of people that do.
Oh, there's people who thought they were going to make a lot of money on that, and including me. And the lesson I learned is, you know, you got to collect things that you really have a passion for.
Yeah.
And if your passion is for seafood can labels or cigar boxes or fruit, man, do that. And if you make money at it, so much the better.
Mm-hmm.
And what I sense from chatting with you today is that you really had an appreciation for the art and for the industry around these, and that's what really got you hooked. Is that a fair conclusion?
Yeah, no, that's very fair. I think as far as like the business part of it, I have a business degree too. I think if you're going to start a business like this, you have to be very disciplined. You have to have like a goal. You have to have like a plan and things like that. I see a lot of people. I mean, it's easy. There's so much bulk on some of this stuff. I mean, some of these labels, there's one of a kinds all the way up to 75,000 of them. And you know, a lot of it is the labor involved. If you buy a label for $5, it's pretty much a labor of the person getting it together and sending it to you.
Right.
And so people see these sell for like a dollar each, and they're going, well, I can buy them for a dollar and sell them for $5. But it's not that easy.
Well, and if it were, everybody... Everybody would be doing it. Now, I know, Dwayne, you also, in addition to your website, you have other places where you appear. Are there any shows where you'll be appearing or any other kind of media interviews in your immediate future where we might see you?
I won't be on anything. I stay pretty close to home as far as like shows and things like that. I think I mentioned there's... I sent a bunch of labels to this Nate Verkus, and they're supposed to air Monday.
Oh, okay. So
the 21st.
Okay, so since the show is taped, can you give us an approximate date when you think the Nate Verkus TV show will be on?
It looks like she told me Monday the 21st. I haven't seen that on this Saturday. I'll know for sure.
Okay.
But they're going to do a show on, he does decorating.
Right.
So what he's going to do is he's going to do a show that's reasonably priced collectibles that may go up in value. And I know on this prior show, him and his mom were in some antique malls. So I think what they're doing is they're just looking at how you can decorate with antiques and things like that. So it might be kind of interesting. I think it might be a little bit of a boost.
It would have to be. He's got millions of viewers.
He is pretty big. He's pretty popular.
And what did you send him, just out of curiosity? I don't want to spoil the segment, but... So spoiler alert, everybody.
It's kind of funny when you get these people, like, they're always in a hurry. Whenever you get a set like that, they're always in a hurry, and they have to have them overnighted. And so what happens is I can tell by the way they buy their labels, they'll get a variety of different things, but they always get A, B, C. They don't get very far into the site. And the website has, like, 8,500 items on it. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is I know they just didn't take the time. So what I did is I picked out a couple comical ones. I picked out some with really great graphics, a couple that have, like, real good fruit vignettes and things like that. And I threw in a bunch of extra stuff that more represented what people like.
Well, when you find out the final, when the airing is, let me know, and, you know, we'll include it in the write-up about our interview today on the Collector's Show.
Okay. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's going to be a go, but once it does it, then I'll drop you an email.
That would be great. Dwayne Rogers, who's the label man, and if you want to see all 8,500 of his labels, everything from orange crate labels to seeds, cigar boxes, you name it, he's got it, and a bona fide expert, you can visit his website, thelabelman.com. And Dwayne Rogers, thank you so much for being with us today on the Collector Show.
Thank you, Harold. It was a lot of fun.
Doctor, doctor, there's nothing I can take. I said, doctor, doctor.